Before we get into part two of the assassination of Clarence Ray Hudgens, we'd like to tell y'all about how you can help solve cold cases. If you're a regular Gone Cold listener, you likely already know about the important and immensely successful work Authorm Incorporated does. And as always, we'll provide a link in this episode's show notes to DNASolves.com, where you can donate to crowdfunding cases or upload your DNA data to the database there so you can help identify Jane and John Doe's, or maybe even help catch a bad guy. But there's another great way to help. Recently, Fort Worth Cold Case Detectives launched the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group. Unfortunately, funds available for the investigative efforts and DNA testing on cold cases is severely lacking, and the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group is the best way to help this incredibly dedicated cold case unit, a small group of detectives whose efforts have proven successful, most notably, of course, with the resolution of the 1974 case of Carla Walker. We will provide information and a link in all our episodes' show notes for the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group from this point forward. Along with Gone Cold's regular contributions to crowdfunding cases at DNASolves.com, we'll also be making regular donations to the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group. And if you are able to join us and do the same, we'd appreciate it more than words can express. The Fort Worth Cold Case Unit has already brought justice and peace to the Walker family, Rodney McCoy, and countless locals, and with your donation, you can be a part of the justice that is sure to come. Thanks, y'all. Now, on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Texas Ranger Captain Jim Ray called Glenn Elliott, quote, "one of the greatest, if not the greatest, field ranger that has ever lived," end quote. Born on August 1, 1926 in Fannin County, Texas, Glenn Elliott began his lengthy career in public service during World War II as an MP in Kobe, Japan, as part of the United States Army's occupation force. After he was discharged, Elliott returned to his high school sweetheart in Windham, Texas, who he had married just before enlisting in the service. Though he'd later remark that his time as a military policeman had nothing to do with it, Elliott enrolled in Highway Patrol School at Camp Mabry in Austin shortly after working a series of jobs that just didn't suit him for a few years after his return to the States. On June 1, 1949, Glenn Elliott officially became a Texas Department of Public Safety Highway Patrolman, serving in Longview. Field rangers and higher-ups eventually took notice of Elliott's hard work, determination, courage, and strictly-by-the-book style of policing, and in 1961, he was promoted to Texas Ranger. He remained in the Gregg and Harrison County areas, where he'd worked highway patrol, which was a rare occurrence back then. The Texas Department of Public Safety's decision to promote Elliott paid off. He thought outside of the box, and thought fast. His brain was made for detective work. In fact, Elliott was known to see details others missed, including details hiding in plain sight in all the local newspaper's daily crime articles, which he read every morning. He quickly gained the reputation of a ranger who always nabbed his suspect. Most often, if Glenn Elliott was on the case, that case was resolved in no time. But there are always exceptions, no matter how good you are. When 75-year-old Inez Phillips was found brutally beaten in her bed, a large knife still protruding from her chest, Glenn Elliott obsessed about the case until 2 years later when he and Gregg County Sheriff's Office investigators solved it. Mrs. Phillips was the widow of a prominent oilman and former Gladewater, Texas mayor, Lois Phillips. Ranger Elliott was well acquainted with the crime associated with the world of oil, involving both the executive types and the roughnecks. In oil-filled rich East Texas, he'd investigated countless illegal wells, large-scale equipment thefts, and virtually every other extremely high-stakes crime concerning black gold you can think of. When 27-year-old Clarence Ray Hudgens was firebombed and gunned down in the early morning hours of October 17, 1981, Glenn Elliott, who had 20 years as a ranger at that point, was as stumped as the Kilgore police and the Gregg County Sheriff's Office. Less than 2 years after Ray's assassination, after the case had gone completely cold as far as authorities were concerned, the arrest of a man in Montague County briefly changed the trajectory of the case. When 46-year-old Henry Lee Lucas started confessing to every unsolved crime under the sweltering Texas sun and beyond, somehow an East Texas murder that was only reported on locally, and scantly at that, got pulled into the serial confessor's macabre menagerie of tall tales that promised fame, infamy, and all the strawberry milkshakes he could drink. In 1981, East Texas was slammed with a series of murders. The many investigations taking place in Wood, Cherokee, Van Zandt, Smith, and Gregg counties that year spanned the gamut of motives, from depraved sexually motivated slayings to those of domestic violence, and from what appeared to be drug-related executions to robberies or burglaries gone wrong, resulting in a killing or killings. The ambush assassination of Ray Hudgens on October 17, 1981, however, appeared to be something else entirely. A methodically planned hit that seemed to have had a contingency plan for any little thing that might go wrong. Many of these cases were still unsolved by the second half of 1983, including Ray's, of course, when Henry Lee Lucas was apprehended and began taking credit for virtually any crime an investigator liked him for. Exactly how the serial confessor and his cohort, Otis Elwood Toole, became a part of the mythology of Clarence Ray Hudgens' murder case differs depending on who you ask. But with a ton of cases going cold throughout East Texas, the possibility that one boogeyman was responsible for a handful, and better still, he'd been caught, was almost irresistible for investigators looking to clear the books. We'll try and flesh out what happened, how it happened, while remaining fair. Without taking too much time going into the painstaking task of detailing the crimes, capture, and serial confessions of Henry Lee Lucas, here's the simplified version. On October 3, 1982, police in Needles, California, discovered the abandoned vehicle that belonged to a man who'd been staying in Stoneburg, Texas, just north of Bowie in Montague County. This discovery was huge for the Montague County Sheriff's Office, who'd been seeking the owner in connection with the disappearance of 82-year-old Kate Rich, a longtime Ringgold, Texas resident who hadn't been seen since Thursday, September 16, 1982. Bloodstains were observed in the vehicle discovered by authorities in Needles, but there was no sign of the owner, 46-year-old Henry Lee Lucas. Less than 5 months before Kate Rich vanished, Lucas and Becky Powell were picked up hitchhiking by a man named Reuben Moore, a roofer by day and Pentecostal minister by passion. Lucas was smart, Moore said. Not only was he a good reader and writer, but the drifter was also polite and a pleasure to be around. Since he could repair just about anything you put in front of him, and Moore needed a handyman to work around his properties and church, he gave Henry Lee Lucas and Becky Powell a place to stay in a converted barn, and Lucas began performing work for the man and other locals. Lucas was good, Moore said, and well-liked around the small, tight-knit community. No one knew he'd spent 10 years in prison for killing his abusive mother. So in August 1982, when Becky Powell disappeared, Becky was Lucas's 15-year-old traveling companion who he was raping. They believed him when he said she'd taken off with a trucker for Florida, back home. Less than a month later, however, Kate Rich came up missing, and knowing Lucas spent plenty of time at the elderly woman's home, doing repairs and performing odd jobs, and that he left town for about a month at the very same time she disappeared, the seed of suspicion was planted in his landlord's mind, though he still found it hard to believe that his well-mannered tenant was capable of murder. Upon the discovery of his car in Needles, California, Henry Lee Lucas was brought into the Montague County Sheriff's Office for questioning. Investigators knew Lucas was responsible for Mrs. Rich's disappearance, but since they had no evidence, they were forced to let him go. Lucas's landlord, Reuben Moore, began believing the authorities' accusations that his tenant harmed Kate Rich after Lucas made threats against him, once even stuffing a water-doused curtain in the exhaust of Moore's heating unit in January of 1983, causing his room to fill up with fatal gases. Luckily, Moore made it out, but after that and several other threats to his life, the landlord wanted Lucas caught as much as lawmen. When Henry Lee Lucas came to Moore with a loaded .22 caliber pistol to hold for him, Moore went straight to the Montague County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff W.F. Conway and Texas Ranger Phil Ryan, another legendary Texas top cop, were elated. Learning Lucas, a felon, was in possession of a firearm was just what they needed to make an arrest. Ranger Ryan did just that on Saturday, June 11, 1983. A few days later, after being held in the Montague County Jail under what Lucas and his court-appointed attorney called inhumane conditions that were, quote, calculated solely to require the defendant to confess guilt, whether innocent or guilty, 46-year-old Henry Lee Lucas confessed to the murders of 82-year-old Kate Rich and Becky Powell, his underaged traveling companion slash longtime victim, and niece to Lucas's partner in crime, Otis Elwood Toole. Newspapers identified Becky as Lucas's 15-year-old common-law wife. Weird. On Tuesday, June 21st, 1983, Lucas's arraignment was held for the murder of Kate Rich, whose bone fragments had been found a few days earlier in the wood-burning stove of the converted barn where he'd been living in Stoneburg. When Judge Frank Douthat asked if he understood the seriousness of the charges against him, Henry Lee Lucas responded, "Yes, sir, I have about 100 of them." Thus started the years-long saga of the serial confessor. A saga that remains the reason for the lack of resolution on countless cases, whether they were cleared as the result of false confession or have simply gone cold since. Meanwhile, Lucas's longtime traveling companion and lover, 36-year-old Otis Elwood Toole, sat in jail in Jacksonville, Florida, after he was arrested and charged with arson in April of 1983, and subsequently confessed to the abduction, murder, and dismemberment of 6-year-old Adam Walsh. Before getting into Lucas and Toole and how they intersected with Ray's case, there are a few important facts to consider up front. We spoke last episode about Ray getting a call warning him that someone was on their way to his equipment yard near Shreveport, Louisiana, to destroy his property, and that certainly was not the only time this happened. What we didn't discuss is that in the months leading up to his murder, Ray Hudgens was receiving threatening phone calls. The exact nature of these calls is unknown, and perhaps the threats themselves weren't specific, but the following account, as told to us by Ray's mother, Catherine Hudgens, paints a fairly vivid picture of what the calls were about. We know these calls had Ray worried, and they appear to have been business-related, oilfield-related. 2 weeks prior to the firebombing of Ray's trailer and his subsequent murder, Ray Hudgens asked his mother if she would quit her job and come work for him. His company, Oilfield Blasting and Coating Incorporated, was doing quite well. In fact, Ray had become known as someone who could get the job done on time and with quality work at a fair price. Ray needed someone he could trust, he told his mother Catherine, because others involved in the company were skimming off the top, stealing money from the man. All of these events took place in 1981, leading up to the murder of Clarence Ray Hudgens. Catherine Hudgens fully intended to quit her job and come work for her son, but she didn't get that chance. He was ambushed and assassinated before she could. Before he was killed, Ray brought two boxes filled with paperwork to his mother and asked her to keep an eye on them.
"If I get killed and they rule it an accident," Ray told Catherine, "I want you to promise me you'll go to the cops and you'll need these boxes to prove it."
We'll get into the context of that next episode, but I think I've made my point here. Henry Lee Lucas, or Otis Elwood Toole for that matter, didn't go around leaving a bunch of incriminating documents behind. They were drifters, and if they were guilty of even a fraction of 1% of the crimes Henry Lee Lucas confessed to, the murder of Ray Hudgens was absolutely not one of them. It is, in fact, impossible, but we'll get into that down the line. After his June 11, 1983 arrest, and his proclamation at his court arraignment that he killed over 100 women, investigators from all over began phoning Texas Ranger Phil Ryan with details of their unsolved homicides. Ranger Ryan responded in a by-the-book way. Without supplying Lucas any information at all, he listened to the man's so-called confessions, and if any details matched the crimes reported to Ranger Ryan from outside agencies, he'd call those investigators back and go over it with them. Over in Williamson County, meanwhile, Sheriff Jim Boutwell had a problem. A series of crimes being referred to in the press as the Interstate 35 murders. His department was struggling to solve them, struggling to even produce leads. But that all changed when he heard of Henry Lee Lucas. Boutwell obtained a warrant to pick up Lucas and bring him back to his neck of the woods. Lucas was moved to the Williamson County Jail in Georgetown, Texas, under the watch of Sheriff Jim Boutwell and Texas Ranger Bob Prince, who headed up a quickly formed task force strictly dedicated to sorting out the confessions of their new prisoner. After he was moved to the Williamson County Jail in Georgetown, Henry Lee Lucas was rarely seen again without Sheriff Jim Boutwell, and a fiasco that cost Texas taxpayers countless millions of dollars, and, though much later, cost the Texas Rangers something they'd held on to since their formation, when Texas was still a republic, the trust of many Texans. But it's important to remember here that many Rangers, if not most, considered Lucas and Boutwell's little fortune and glory party to be utter bullshit. Anyway, Boutwell was something of a legend even before he became a lawman. When Charles Whitman was firing upon students from the Bell Tower at the University of Texas in Austin in 1966, Boutwell, a civilian at the time, piloted a small plane alongside Austin Police Lieutenant Marion Lee, so Lee could exchange fire with Whitman while reporting back to boots-on-the-ground officers. This significantly slowed down the barrage of bullets toward the UT students and faculty on the ground, likely saving many lives. Boutwell became a big deal after that, and it is amazing, don't get me wrong here, but his legend grew as both the result of sensationalistic newspaper reports that had him piloting the plane and firing the weapon, and his own exaggerations, which were as often as they were self-aggrandizing. 13 years after the University of Texas sniper shooting, Jim Boutwell ran for and became sheriff of Williamson County. 4 years after that, Henry Lee Lucas gave the man who'd become a legend as a civilian the chance to become one as a lawman. With Sheriff Boutwell's new, "Come on in, be sure to bring your unsolved case file with you to refresh Henry's memory," style of helping investigators from all over the United States with their unresolved caseload, It was only natural that authorities back in Gregg County would be curious if this monster had been satisfying his depraved urges in their parts. At some point, East Texas field ranger Glenn Elliott thought it'd be a good idea to check this guy out for some crimes in his jurisdiction. After arranging to meet with the serial confessor sometime in 1984, Ranger Elliott became even more interested. Henry Lee Lucas, according to Elliott, said that his drifter companion, Otis Elwood Toole, was having an affair with Clarence Ray Hudgens, and after some sort of lover's quarrel, Lucas went on, Toole killed Ray. Now, this account given by Lucas to Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott is nothing short of a complete and total fabrication, one that hung on such a thin thread that no further investigation was really warranted at all. Number one, Ray was not gay or even bisexual. This can be attested to by each and every person who ever knew him. Number two, there is literally no detail of the circumstances of Ray's murder that suggests his death was the result of a lover's spat, not a single one. In fact, the facts surrounding Ray's case suggest something far more sinister and complicated. Still, Ranger Elliott arranged to bring Lucas back with him to Gregg County to visit the crime scene. Two brutal slayings in August of 1982 are perhaps the cases that prompted Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott to seek out Henry Lee Lucas for crimes in his jurisdiction. The overkill murder of a Smith County woman, 36-year-old Catherine Laura Powell, on the 6th of that month, and on the 16th, the savage killing of a 41-year-old Kilgore school teacher named Jan Alice Hudson. Catherine Powell was raped, strangled with her own t-shirt, and shot in the head with a shotgun. Jan Hudson was raped and bludgeoned to death with a fireplace shovel and stabbed with a fireplace poker. Otis Elwood Toole, according to Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott, was good for the Hudson murder after the lawman and Henry Lee Lucas visited the scene. Lucas, he told Elliott and fellow ranger Stuart Dowell, had waited in the car. But the serial confessor's landlord in Stoneburg, Texas, reported that Lucas stayed put there and did no traveling until at least the end of August. Still, Toole confessed, and it appears the murder was cleared as the result of that confession. It's far from the only one. According to newspapers, Catherine Powell's murder was also cleared as the result of Lucas's confessions, but luckily, it was never officially cleared. In 2005, DNA testing performed on crime scene evidence proved that a man in prison for a brutal, unconnected 1984 rape, Thomas Earl Dunn, killed Catherine. If not for Smith County Cold Case Unit Detective Joe Rasko's doubts that Lucas and Toole were involved in Catherine's terrible slaying, the case might be still unsolved today, perhaps thought of as cleared by Lucas and Toole. Perhaps, too, Lucas's bogus confession implicating his partner Otis Elwood Toole for the murder of Clarence Ray Hudgens stifled progress on his case. Catherine Hudgens, at this point, had been all but completely ousted from receiving any information from East Texas authorities about her son's murder. She already believed strongly that she knew some of the players involved in Ray's death, and she wasn't keeping quiet about it as she continued to pressure law enforcement into checking out those leads. But there were folks inside both the Kilgore Police Department and the Gregg County Sheriff's Office who secretly kept Catherine in the loop, even though it would cost them their jobs if their commanding officers found out. When Ranger Elliott arrived back in Gregg County with Henry Lee Lucas in tow, one of those officers informed Catherine that they were on their way to Ray's property. After they visited the crime scene, Ranger Elliott phoned Catherine Hudgens and asked if she had possession of Ray's files. Specifically, he said, he was looking for employment records to see if he could spot Toole's name anywhere on them. She had everything, Catherine told Elliott, even his pencil sharpener. But she had a message of her own for the lawman. Her son's murder was a local job, Catherine told Ranger Elliot, and he better not even think about trying to pin the crime on Henry Lucas or Otis Toole.
I'm not trying to help Lucas,
Catherine Hudgens later told the Waco Tribune Herald.
He's bad, but I don't want anyone to put the blame on him and let those other murderers go free.
Nowhere in Ray's paperwork mentions the name Henry Lee Lucas or Otis Toole, and Catherine's refusal to acknowledge the possibility that Lucas killed her son further soured her relationship with law enforcement, and especially Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott. The two rarely, if ever, spoke again. The details of the Lucas fiasco, as they pertain to the Ray Hudgens murder case, weren't publicized at all until around a year later. In Waco, Texas, McLennan County District Attorney Vic Fiesel began investigating crimes said to be cleared by Lucas in his jurisdiction after Dallas Times-Herald investigative reporter Hugh Ainsworth exposed a majority of the confessions as hoaxes in April of 1985. Ainsworth painstakingly accounted for Lucas and Toole's movements through prison records, employment records, and other documents. What he found was unmistakable and undeniable proof that these drifters weren't responsible for a vast majority of the slayings Lucas confessed to and implicated Toole in. Henry Lee Lucas even recanted to everything he had confessed to, saying his mother was the only person he'd ever killed, which also is likely not true at all. He began his confession spree, Lucas said, due to the conditions he was forced to live in while incarcerated. After he began admitting to everything, it was nothing but chit-chatting it up with Sheriff Boutwell and other investigators while eating cheeseburgers, drinking strawberry milkshakes, and taking trips across Texas and the rest of the United States in a cozy private jet, the use of which was allocated specifically to the Henry Lee Lucas Task Force. The serial confessor was basically only in his cell to sleep at night. Lucas then teeter-tottered back, saying that DA Vic Fiesel, reporter Hugh Ainsworth, and Attorney General Jim Maddox were forcing him to deny the truth. The truth being that he and Toole had been captured by a satanic cult called the Hand of Death, forced to perform ritualistic murders, necrophilia, and some incoherent babble that has to do with Jonestown cult leader Jim Jones. Say what you want about Lucas, the guy was an expert bullshitter. In late April 1985, Catherine Hudgens and her daughter Jerry Ann, Ray's sister, traveled to Waco to meet with McLennan County District Attorney Vic Fiesel. Since Clarence Ray Hudgens' murder didn't occur within his county, there was little he could do legally speaking. In an article published in the Waco Tribune Herald, Texas Ranger Glenn Elliott is quoted as saying that he never believed Henry Lee Lucas nor Otis Elwood Toole were involved in Ray's ambush assassination. That statement is likely true, and you can interpret it however you'd like. In the Lucas Report, released by Texas Attorney General Jim Maddox in 1986, Toole is shown to have been in Jacksonville, Florida, leading up to and just after Ray was killed. And on that very day, Saturday, October 17, 1981, Henry Lee Lucas purchased a 1973 Chevy station wagon in Jacksonville. It would have been virtually impossible for either man to have committed the crime.
There are some people wearing white hats that should be wearing black hats,
Catherine Hudgens told the Waco newspaper in 1985. Coming up on Gone Cold, we'll explore what is perhaps the most likely motive for the slaying of Ray Hudgens. If you have any information about the assassination of Clarence Ray Hudgens, please contact Gregg County Crime Stoppers at 903-236-7867. We'd like to thank Catherine Hudgens for her contributions to this episode. The Waco Tribune Herald, The Washington Times, The Kilgore News Herald, The Tyler Morning Telegraph, the United Press International Archives, TexasRanger.org, and the Longview News Journal were used as sources for this episode. You can find Gone Cold on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using @GoneColdPodcast. We're also now on YouTube, where we hope to bring y'all the podcast in a kind of a different way, coming fairly soon. So go to youtube.com/C/GoneColdPodcast and subscribe. We'd greatly appreciate it if you did. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50 a month, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Riverside Village Massacre, Parts 1 and 2, and our episode Doped Up and Ready to Kill, among others. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. If you like what we're doing here, you can also support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating and short review on iTunes. Reviews on iTunes help make Gone Cold visible to more people, and the more folks who listen to these stories, the greater the likelihood someone will come forward with information. If you have not already, we would immensely appreciate your 5-star rating and review there. Thanks for listening, y'all.